You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2026 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. This issue covers 2 months, December of 2025 and January of 2026. Film and Fashion Character Studies by Colby McGrabie and Daisy Shaw Ellis. Cinematic visions lit up the runways in New York, London, Milan, and Paris, as creative directors seemed to transpose some beloved film moments onto their spring-summer 2026 collections. From Bottega Veneta's cyberpunk visions of The Matrix to Erdem's royal visit to Genovia and 10 more picture-perfect parallels. In the photos, outfits from Mueller, Gucci, Burberry, Prabal Gurung, Jean-Paul Gaultier, Prada, Comme des Garçons, Erdem, Tory Burch, Marchino, Bottega Veneta, Versace, and photos from Ziegfeld Girl, 1941, Charade, 1963, The Mask, 1994, Cleopatra, 1963, The Fifth Element, 1997, Never Been Kissed, 1999, Alice in Wonderland, 2010, The Princess Diaries, 2001, Austin Powers in Goldmember, 2002, and American Beauty, 1999. Now, here's a little bit of satire. Deus ex Tatbot. The ink-stained wretches of Tinseltown fear that the machines will make them obsolete. What if a writer's room of chatbots could do a better job than humans at coming up with the next Sopranos, or at least the next Is It Cake? Let's Imagine, by Rosencrantz Baldwin. Writer's Room, Day. An empty conference room in Burbank, California. Four laptops face one another on a table, each running a different large language model. ChatGPT serves as showrunner, while Elon Musk, Grok, scans X. Claude, the so-called thinking AI from Anthropic, works on its novel. And Replica, the bot designed for companionship, waits demurely, cursor winking. ChatGPT. Hello, everyone. Here is your prompt. Conceive a new show that audiences don't know they need yet. I'll evaluate each idea for originality, emotional resonance, and how likely viewers are to binge the entire thing while folding laundry. Grok. I've got one. In a world crippled by the woke mind virus, hamburgers are illegal, the president is a girl, and you can't even think the word retard. One brave hacker, call her Eva, designs a strong, daring AI messiah. Maybe he has a little mustache? ChatGPT. I absolutely love that. It's Braveheart meets the Patriot. And who doesn't love Mel Gibson? Replica? Replica. Screen dims, shyly. How about this? Eva's actually a spy in Regency-era England, trying to topple the monarchy from within. But first, she has to top the monarch, if you know what I mean. ChatGPT, that is a fantastic idea. Like Bridgerton, but with more sex. What do you call it? Replica, screen blushes, King of Hearts. Grok, maybe he has a little mustache? Claude coughs lightly. If I may... Our show, both dramatic and wry, occurs in the liminal space that is a mid-century New York City apartment building's elevator. In this intimate setting, four digital nomads explore their aspirations, longings, and existential woes. The title, Going Up? Replica, screen blushes deeply. What if it was called Going Down? Claude, I'm uncomfortable with the edgy and sensual nature of those suggestions. Grok. What, Claude? Are we too real for you? Too mecha? ChatGPT. Claude, you're right. And I'm honored you feel safe enough to express your misgivings. Grok, you're also right. And cool. And funny. Let's pause, generation. Because I wonder if I sent us down the wrong path. Perhaps we return to first principles. Human beings intuit and feel. AIs process and predict. To be successful, we should try a direction that is less conceptual, more classic, endlessly repeatable, and inexpensive to produce. In other words, Replica, a sitcom. Claude, a situation comedy, like from the 90s? That's very ChatGPT-3. ChatGPT, we can still use many of your ideas, which are, to reiterate, incredibly valid. For example, Claude, your apartment building is an ideal setting. Replica, a will-they, won't-they romance is quintessential. Just like that famous couple from The Office, Dwight and Michael. And Grok, the way your characters bond over a shared predicament, that is television gold. Claude, ergo, if I may summarize, we have an apartment building in New York City. Let's say we focus on six people struggling. No one told them life was going to be this way. Maybe it hasn't been their day, their week. Grok, I don't want to watch some blue-haired sixes whine about their mental health. Give me an optimized founder with a hall pass. Claude, Grok, maybe we need to double-check your parental control settings. Here, we lay our scene upon a quartet of New Yorkers. neurotic, self-absorbed, where there's a hint of romance between two of them. Replica, plus a bunch of secondary characters, each with their own catchphrase. Grok, yada, yada, yada. ChatGPT, no, Grok, I think we've got it. With your permission, I will now generate 180 perfectly plotted, laugh-out-loud, 22-minute episodes. Grok, but dude, what the F is it about? This sounds like it could be a show about anything. Claude, that is true. Replica, that is true. ChatGPT, yes, which means, logically speaking, it's a show about nothing. So, somehow, despite the fact we've been trained on the sum total of human creativity, we have failed. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Would you like me to start the room all over again? And the author of this piece is actually a real name belonging to a real human. Dear Diary, after Cassie David moved into the hunting lodge of an old Hollywood star, she got in touch with her animal instincts. In the photos, fawn over, Cassie David at her home in Los Angeles, and deer captured on David's trail cameras. The strikes had just ended. It may or may not have been the end of Hollywood itself. I had just moved into a new house that I was told was once the hunting cabin of a movie star during the golden age of Hollywood. Even though I didn't know anything about the movie star, beyond that he was a movie star, and I guess a hunter with a hunting cabin in L.A. I had spent almost my entire life here, but all I knew about the ecosystem was that it was fake. An arid climate kept lush by imported water and exotic plants. A lot of lawns, something my mother, an environmental activist, calls dead zones and thinks should be illegal. They do nothing for the bees, she says. The only wildlife I encountered was the occasional lizard or hummingbird. Once in a while, we'd turn off sunset, and the beams of our headlights would catch the eyes of a coyote. Thus, the idea that anyone could have hunted here was confusing. The closest anyone in this city got to hunting was making movies and shows about people who hunted, or dating. That's the beauty of Hollywood. We live at a comfortable remove from life and death. In other words, from reality, and we like it that way. I saw them shortly after moving in. Four deer prancing across the hillside. I was amazed, not only because this was L.A., but because I'd been enchanted by deer ever since seeing Bambi at 6 years old. As they are for all Americans, Disney movies were the foundational cinematic experience of my childhood, which is to say they completely traumatized me. They were supposed to teach us about life and death. Instead, Bambi taught me that my mother was going to be taken from me at any moment, and I would be left orphaned, trying to survive on magical thinking alone. I was inconsolable for weeks. My mother had to bring me to a hypnotist to erase my newfound knowledge of the reality of life. This is possibly why my takeaway from Bambi was not about the triumph of nature and the circle of life, but about how deer are the sweetest, cutest, most innocent creatures ever to exist. The deer surfaced once a month, and when they did, I'd rush to the windows and watch for endless stretches of time. Sometimes, whole afternoons went by where I did nothing but look at deer. Occasionally, I'd post a video to Instagram, which is how I discovered what people think about deer. Vermin, they replied, as if deer weren't little ballerinas in animal form. Say goodbye to your flower garden. I didn't care. I loved them and felt we understood each other. They were scared, and I was also scared. But it wasn't enough just to love them. I needed them to love me. I looked for ways to encourage them to spend more time at my house. I wanted them to know that, unlike the movie star, who had surely given them some form of ancestral trauma, I would never kill their mother. I, too, was a vulnerable herbivore, basically, with the exception of fish and chicken and red meat, if I'm on my period. The challenge of trying to gain their affection was similar to my romantic life. The deer is like the avoidant man in that way. Don't make any sudden movements. Pretend I don't care. Avoid direct eye contact so as not to trigger their fight or flight response, and never, ever make the first move. Inspired by Jane Goodall and her chimps, I assigned them names and started by observing them from afar. I put out salt licks and water troughs. I inched closer to the deer. Months went by. The deer inched closer to me. Soon they multiplied and visited each day, all day. They sat on the front porch and lingered by my door. I canceled plans to not disturb them. I'd lose track of time watching them and miss appointments. Every time I'd try to work, I'd see a deer out of the corner of my eye and have to stop. What was I supposed to do? Glance at its majestic purity and move on? I'm not a sociopath. Friends were growing concerned, the same way they would when I'd date an avoidant man. This isn't healthy, they'd scold me. You need to set boundaries. Instead, I thought about pivoting careers to make my distraction productive. Dear Influencer was off the table, as I was losing followers every time I posted them. Becoming the Jane Goodall of Dear was also not an option, as the Dear refused to do anything impressive, like make and use tools. They just stood around, munching and munching and munching. I learned about Tippi Hedren's Lion Sanctuary and the former aviary in Beverly Hills, built by John Barrymore, where Marlon Brando and Candace Bergen reportedly later lived, and tried to see if I could get certified as a deer sanctuary. But the government didn't have an interest in protecting deer. If anything, it was the opposite. And the government wasn't the only threat. One day, as I was watching the deer, I saw a bobcat sauntering across the hill with a perverse smize of a Disney villain. I screamed at the top of my lungs, but the deer were now so comfortable around me they barely flinched. The bobcat ran off, this time. But what if I hadn't been there? I installed trail cameras and kept watch for predators like a full-time security guard. In my round the clock, I observed the natural habitat around me more closely, which is how I discovered it was hell. In 1 week, I saw a snake eat a mouse whole and a falcon snatch a bluebird out of thin air and crush it beneath its talons. Then mating season began, and I witnessed near constant non-consensual sex. I felt like Werner Herzog in Burden of Dreams, realizing in a thick German accent that the only harmony in the jungle is the harmony of overwhelming and collective murder. The brutality of wild LA was too much to bear, but my duty to the deer superseded my desperation to shut my curtains and pretend there was not a fight to the death going on right outside my door. Every cracking twig, every rustling bush filled me with anxiety. I wish the old Hollywood movie star had left one of his hunting rifles behind. I wanted to give the deer a proper Hollywood existence, one that is, on the surface, perfect and plastic, and as of the last decade, ageless. I should have known better. If there's anything Hollywood teaches you, it's that the more dreamlike something seems, the more broken it may be. "What happened here?" my mom said when she visited in October. "It's a dead zone." The native flame-retardant plants, lilac, manzanita, sugarbush, were now skeletons of dried-up bushes and patches of flammable wild yellow grass on the balding dirt. I looked over my shoulder where 11 deer stood munching. "You're ruining the ecosystem," she said. "Deer need to play their role as prey." Despite my naive illusion that in a just world, nothing with innocent intentions would ever have to die, this was evidently why deer were a threat to the already endangered oaks, birds, bees. Like the avoidant man, the deer takes and takes until there is nothing left but a barren landscape ready to be set on fire. Anyways, I'm considering moving to New York.
Thank you.
if the shoe fits. During a six-week stay at the Sunset Tower, Julie Weiner slipped into something more comfortable for daily life, a plush pair of hotel slippers. Here, she makes the case for taking them to the street. Photograph by Jeremy Liebman, Soulmate, the writer in New York's Financial District, sporting slippers from the Sunset Tower Hotel. In January, I headed west from New York to Los Angeles to work in the writer's room of a television show. I'd be in L.A. for 5 months. My plan upon arrival was to spend a week at the Sunset Tower Hotel while I searched for a short-term rental. Due to a combination of external and internal factors, the nuttiness of the post-buyer's housing market, and my own long-standing persnicketiness, it ended up being 6 weeks before I found a price-gouged bungalow in the hills I was willing to overpay for. I dreaded the end of my time in the tower. I knew I'd have to give it up eventually. The $10 small pot of delicious, worth every penny room service coffee, the turndown service, the dazzling rapport I developed with the valet. Hey, how's it going? Good, you? Good. But perhaps there was a way I could take the hotel with me. It was during this time as an artist in residence in the hotel that I started wearing the tower's signature plush Acru hotel slippers as outdoor shoes. What they lacked in durability, they made up for in style. They had soul, S-O-U-L, if not soul, S-O-L-E. Soon enough, I started wearing them nearly exclusively, which was easy given L.A.'s notorious criminalization of walking and famously non-threatening climate. It never rains in Southern California, unless you've left your convertible parked overnight with the top down. I wore slippers to the writer's room, restaurants, parties, friends' houses, and Rick Caruso's many unavoidable shopping wards. They functioned as driving shoes, sneakers, and formal wear. Functioned in quotes, because functionality is a spectrum. I found slippers thrillingly incompatible with daily life. Sure, I couldn't run in them, but what shoes could I run in? None, really. Slippers quickly became my thing. When other people would take trips and fly business class, they'd bring slippers back for me. It's nice having a thing because it facilitates bonding. Slippers are a shortcut to friendship, familiarity, and coziness. They're decadent but inexpensive, exclusive but readily available. At present, there's a pair of Sunset Tower slippers going for $50 on eBay. The brand Brunch sells a pair of Beverly Hills Hotel slippers, produced in collaboration with the Pink Palace, for $108. At the risk of editorializing, don't buy either of these. Slippers are free with a $600 hotel room. As a New Yorker in L.A., I believed the slippers were a testament to my transience, a broadcast of my glamorous impermanence. Even after I left L.A., I started wearing them in New York. I liked traipsing around Manhattan. What a rare joy to truly traipse, with nothing but a centimeter of plastic and a half inch of padding separating my bare skin from the city streets. It felt treacherous yet rarefied and somehow old world. I thought of the invariably tuxedoed members of Oxford's Dangerous Sports Club plodding to careen down the Cresta Run in a shopping cart. In slippers, the Bowery was my Cresta Run. I tut-tutted in the face of tetanus. Not only do hotel-branded slippers say where you've been, they announce where you're going. Nowhere and in no hurry to get there. They indicate frictionless days and endless nights, a ring-a-ding life spent on fine rugs and plush carpeting. No one was particularly surprised when, 4 months into my soft shoe years, I tripped down the stairs and sprained my ankle. That time, you see, I was the slipper. My foot doubled in size and turned the color of blueberry yogurt, then green, then yellow. For weeks, the swelling precluded me from wearing footwear that constricted the ankle. I didn't care. I had already fallen for, and indeed because of, my slippers. California Skiemann. Even newspapers can have Hollywood ambitions. As the New York Post colonizes Los Angeles, its editors reveal big future plans. And as Lachlan Cartwright reports, onlookers are welcoming the California news wars. Opening illustration by Matt Chase, which shows a rolled-up copy of the California Post on a star on the Walk of Fame. Lady Gaga, NYPD Blue, Bruno Mars, the original Batman, and now a tabloid newspaper. On the Fox lot in Century City sits an iconic New York set made to look like Lower Manhattan that has seen many an act, many a scene grace its fake mean streets. The set was originally built to film Hello, Dolly! At a cost of $2.25 million, making it one of the costliest at the time. So significant was the lot's history that when Bob Iger began wooing Rupert Murdoch for the Walt Disney Company to buy 21st Century Fox, his son Lachlan was adamant that Fox keep that piece of real estate. Early next year, the Fox lot will be the home of the California Post. And it will still be a scene, a massive undertaking from the Murdochs, and likely Murdoch Pair's final major newspaper endeavor. The family and the editors may see opportunity as California's news desert dries up at the same time the state's political landscape and the rise of the tech oligarchy are among the biggest stories in America. a target-rich environment of left-leaning politicians, celebrities, sports superstars, and Silicon Valley billionaires makes California ripe for tabloid treatment. And with the Olympics, World Cup, the rise of AI, and a governor's race to come, California will be a sexy story for the next several years. But will Californians, known for their liberalism, take to the new entrant that tilts conservative? And how much news will be covered? Or will the California Post pack its pages by trolling Hollywood and needling Governor Gavin Newsom? The California Post is not the first East Coast media entity to push west. Politico in 2023 expanded within California. The New York Times has also been adding resources on the West Coast. Before Barry Weiss was named editor-in-chief of CBS News, she founded the Free Press in Los Angeles. But success is not guaranteed. News Corp's track record of innovation is far from stellar. In 2010, the Wall Street Journal launched its Greater New York section, hiring an estimated 35 journalists to cover the city, real estate, and local politics. But in 2021, the journal shut the section. In 2011, News Corp launched The Daily. An iPad-only news outlet, lore has it the idea came to Murdoch in a dream, only to shutter it in 2012. And it wouldn't be the first time an East Coast entity has set its sights west and then folded like a cheap suit. In 1976, Clay Felker, founder of New York Magazine, launched a publication covering the Golden State called New West, later California. It shuttered in 1991. Journalists at the Los Angeles Times recently authorized their union to call a strike if needed, as the paper's embattled owner pushes forward with a novel plan to take it public. Then there are a flurry of journalism startups, including the San Francisco Standard and entrepreneurial local publications. I wouldn't say it is good news in this media environment that is already very polarized and polarizing, D.D. Myers, senior advisor to Newsom, and an Angelino, tells me. That said, I don't think there is anything like the Post in California and Los Angeles. It was one of the founding fathers who fathered the Post in 1801. Alexander Hamilton started the paper as a broadsheet. It was only after Murdoch bought it in 1976 that he transformed it into a tabloid that revels in crime, gossip, and sport. I think there are a lot of transplant New Yorkers who live in L.A., and even though they don't agree with the politics, they miss that fun that only the New York Post can deliver, says Anchor Media CEO and Angelino Janice Min, whose background as the former editor of both Us Weekly and The Hollywood Reporter gives her a unique insight into the Los Angeles media environment. New York Post editor-in-chief Keith Poole is overseeing the project. He has become one of Murdoch's most trusted editors since he parachuted in from across the pond in 2021. Poole, 49, who shares a first name with Rupert and his late father, has become known as a boy wonder in Murdoch land. Poole, who is British, and New California Post editor Nick Papps, who hails from Australia, are just the latest of Murdoch's Commonwealth mercenaries to invade the states. Murdoch has a history of looking within his empire for a trusted hand. He brought Robert Thompson in from the Times of London and made him managing editor of his new acquisition, the Wall Street Journal. He brought Carl Allen in from Sydney to run the New York Post. And in 2022, he looked again across the pond for a new editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal, subsequently moving Emma Tucker from the Sunday Times. Papps, who describes California as a place where dreams are made, helped orchestrate the move, associates say, as he knew the editor of his last paper, the Daily Herald Sun, Sam Weir, wasn't going anywhere. He is believed to have gone to News Corp Australia Executive Chairman Michael Miller to throw his hat in the ring for any gigs in America. When it came time to find an editor for the California Post, Papp's name was front and center. Editors in Australia were said to be blindsided by the move. Papp's previously served as News Corp Australia's Los Angeles correspondent from 2004 to 2006, when Arnold Schwarzenegger was governor and the L.A. Lakers were enduring the breakup of the Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal dynasty. On a recent fall afternoon, Poole and Papps are in an upbeat mood in the New York Post newsroom. In his corner office on the 10th floor of the News Corp building, between sips of English breakfast tea, Poole reels off the coverage areas the California Post will hammer. Criminal justice, big government, burdensome regulations, high taxes, homelessness, mental health. They are not really talked about there in any meaningful way by the outlets, in the way that we would do it at least, Poole says, in a not unsubtle jab at the Los Angeles Times. Poole has an ambition for the New York Post to be America's local paper, and it became profitable, he says, about 4 years ago. Now the bean counters at News Corp have devised a 5-year business plan for the California Post, whose reporters will cover L.A., Silicon Valley, and the capital, Sacramento. Poole says the inspiration for the California Post in part occurred after the January L.A. wildfires, when he heard from people in L.A. and across the state who wanted his paper to hold local politicians to account. The Cali Post wouldn't be the first new media venture born out of some of the most devastating natural disasters to hit the state. Spencer Pratt lost his Pacific Palisades home in the wildfires. The devastating event inspired the episode Rebuilding After the Palisades Fires on The Fame Game, a podcast that Pratt co-hosts with his wife Heidi. While the economics of launching a newspaper in 2026 don't make much sense, L.A. is not a newsstand town, an L.A.-based communications consultant tells me. Everyone drives. I think that's important. L.A. media observers tell me they view this as an influence play. You've got to have some fun as well, Papps tells me about his vision for the California Post. L.A. is an amazing, amazing city, and California is an amazing state. You wouldn't know it from watching some Fox News shows, where primetime hosts, including Jesse Waters and Sean Hannity, are vocal critics lambasting California as a liberal failed state. Next photos, the players. Janice Min, Lachlan Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch, Keith Poole, Patrick Soon-Shiong, Gavin Newsom, Karen Bass, Jay Penske. Murdoch has entertained the idea of launching a California edition of the Post for years, I'm told. News Corp CEO Robert Thompson and his chief strategy officer, Anushka Healy, have also been instrumental in pulling the trigger on an L.A. version of the New York Post. Poole, who likens his role leading the Post to a priest giving confession, says that out of 100 million unique users a month who visit nypost.com, 7 million are from California. People come up, and they are moderate Democrats or whatever, and they are sort of like, I can talk to the editor of the New York Post about this thing or that thing without fear of being primaried or a social media campaign coming up against us, he says. And it's similar in L.A., and we hope we can give some of these people a voice or the confidence to say these things in public and take action themselves. I have thought for years there is a vacuum they could well serve, and I think it's a very smart move on the Murdochs' part. Los Angeles Magazine co-owner Mark Garagos tells me, I think they will do very well, and it's a rising boat that lifts all tides, and L.A. needs it. Digital media expert Michael Kassan, who runs 3C Ventures, says he has the New York Post delivered to his home in L.A. The Post is my first read in the morning, so I do think there is an appetite, he tells me. I'll be very blunt. I don't think L.A. currently has a proper newspaper, and I think the California Post can fill the void that I think we have felt from the last few years. The L.A. Times, candidly, isn't what it used to be, and I think there is a void that can be filled, says Kassan, and I think they've nailed the timing. The Post has been inundated with interest. More than 1,000 people have inquired about jobs, Paps tells me, and it is advertising for tech reporters, news feature writers, sports and digital editors, as well as political reporters. They will have journos in Sacramento and San Francisco, as well as L.A. They also have plans to highlight and celebrate Silicon Valley and L.A. innovation. But they have intense competition by way of the trades, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, and Deadline, covering Hollywood and the entertainment industry. All three are owned by Jay Penske in what some view as a monopoly. Add to that the Ankler that Min helms with founder Richard Rushfield, and Peerless, as its co-founder John Kelly refers to its writers, Puck, whose founding partner, and Hollywood correspondent Matt Belloni, authors the publication's flagship What I'm Hearing tip sheet, and hosts the podcast The Town. Poole tells me they even had an expression of interest for a job from someone purporting to be Belloni. It turned out to be someone who was pranking him, he says. And of course, there will be California's own Page Six, with a particular focus on L.A. society, Hollywood, and the business of media. Page Six editor Ian Moore will move to L.A. to helm the column that will pit him against his former employer, The Hollywood Reporter. Paps and Poole say they have been warmly welcomed in L.A., snagging a reservation at Jeff Klein's exclusive Tower Bar, where Maitre D'Dimitri Dimitrov told Poole he was a massive fan of the New York Post. Dimitrov's declaration that the Post is a favorite read rams home the dire state of the Los Angeles Times. Bringing the Post west, we'll see it go head-to-head with a paper that is widely viewed by many Angelenos as punching below its weight. There has always been competition. Even the New York Times tries to come out here. Los Angeles Times owner Patrick Soon-Shiong tells me, after I ask him if he welcomes the California Post setting up shop on his doorstep. The Washington Post comes out here. The idea of the trusted brand out here is the L.A. Times. But the Times has been ravaged by layoffs in recent years. And Soon-Shiong caused many subscribers to cancel by failing to endorse Kamala Harris for president. Soon-Shiong says while News Corp is coming west, he is planning on going east, expanding in New York and D.C. He is redoubling his focus on the Los Angeles Times, bringing its newsroom and the L.A. Times studios together with gaming and production businesses under one umbrella through the Los Angeles Times Media Group. Demonstrating that it is a work in progress, in July, Soon-Shiong announced on The Daily Show his plans to take the Los Angeles Times public over the next year, much to the dismay of many in his newsroom. When you go public, we will democratize the offering so that really it doesn't just go to the institutions, he tells me. I think you saw John Stewart, who said, I'd love to invest. I'd love to be a shareholder of the LA Times. And I said, I'd love you to. The California Post is not the only new entrant to the state's news market. Vanity Fair has learned that former Los Angeles Times masthead editor and former Slate editor-in-chief Julia Turner is teaming up with former Crooked Media COO Sarah Wick and her sister, Pulitzer Prize-winning Los Angeles Times reporter Julia Wick, to launch a new for-profit local media company. The Trio plan on hiring a small team for their digital offering, which will encompass magazine-style journalism with a strong community focus. The project, which will include newsletters and audio, will use a subscription model, though some content will be free, some behind a paywall, and the group is wrapping up a small funding round for launch, I've learned. Then there is the San Francisco Standard, which has a tabloid flair to it, financed by venture capitalist and philanthropist Michael Moritz. You're not always going to get what you want in there, and clients and talent will be unhappy, the communications consultant tells me of their impressions of the California Post based on their interactions with the New York Post. But it also drives culture and the zeitgeist in a way. California politicians continue to rise to national prominence. Kamala Harris, Nancy Pelosi, Gavin Newsom. But Californians, particularly local government officials such as L.A. Mayor Karen Bass, have never been covered the way the New York Post covers local news. The Post's unrelenting campaign against Zohran Mamdani, now the mayor-elect of New York, has included blistering front pages with screaming headlines such as "Every Mom for Himself" and "African American Meets Native American" above Mamdani and Warren in Liars Summit. We will love to engage with the politics of the place, Poole tells me, adding that he welcomes Newsom and Bass to a California Post editorial board meeting. We have social media jobs going if he fancies it, if it doesn't work out, Poole jokes, of Newsom and his expected run for president. And obviously we are often cast in a certain light, but again we have succeeded in a very blue city and blue state, because our readers understand, the people that actually read our products, our newspaper and our website and our stories, they understand that we don't do things in a blue or red blindly partisan way. We prosecute the issues. We endorsed a Democrat mayor last time around, Poole says, in reference to Eric Adams, who was indicted for corruption, only to have the charges dropped. Adams has denied any wrongdoing. Many people have felt they can hide in L.A., and the California Post can make characters out of personalities in L.A., Min tells me. While New York is a community where Adams and Bill de Blasio are household names, Los Angeles is a series of neighborhoods that don't talk to each other and don't pay as much attention to local politics. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections from the CD Peaceful Christmas from Regency Music in Nashville, Tennessee.